Welcome to the Full of Tracy Muddy Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 1:03 PM, that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is September 28th, and gold had a pretty impressive day in here today. In fact, it was a small upside key reversal. But what I think is perhaps more important is that we had bigger and more dynamic moves in both silver and platinum. So this is suggesting that we have lows of at least near-term significance. Now, there is a short-term oversold condition, particularly in silver, and platinum is still trading at a significant discount relative to either of the main precious metals. It has really been a laggard throughout this bull market. It hasn't broken above $1,000 yet. And I do think that as we look progressively at the precious metal markets, it's quite normal in a bull market that gold should move first, then silver moves, then gold shares, then explorers, and then probably platinum and explorers or gold miners are conflated. So platinum as a precious metal is also an industrial metal. It's more of an industrial metal than silver is. When we think about the industrial uses for some of the precious metals, then some are really quite important. And both platinum and silver share some unique characteristics in terms of renewable energy. So gold obviously is a fantastic conductor, and so is silver. Silver's use in photovoltaic cells is well understood, but perhaps what's less well understood is the difficulty in recycling solar panels. There is an increasing quantity of solar panels being produced, and it's extremely difficult and expensive to recycle those panels. So a lot of them are just going to end up in landfill. It means that as time goes by, there's going to be progressively more silver ending up in landfills rather than entering into the recycled market. So that's something of a potential supply inelasticity argument. And then, of course, you have the additional point that silver production from mines, the grades continue to deteriorate. So it's going to require progressively more earth to be moved in order to gain the same quantity of silver. Well, all of those points are exaggerated with platinum. The ore grades have been declining, the mines have been getting deeper, but the demand has certainly taken an enormous hit as a result of the Dieselgate scandal. But platinum is used in hydrogen fuel cells. In fact, some of the platinum companies have been some of the biggest champions of hydrogen fuel cells for specifically that reason. It represents a potential source of new demand. So when we then think about how are some of these hydrogen companies performing, well, they have so far held their breakouts. And this has certainly been a choppy environment. There's absolutely no doubt about that. But when we look at, for example, CWR or then Plug Power has rocketed from the lows put in March and is now at new highs that have not been seen in over a decade. Of course, it's nowhere compared to where it was all the way back in 2000. And it was another one of these companies that did spectacularly well during the mania of 1999. But this move, although impressive, is certainly nothing compared to the kind of enthusiasm for alternative and futuristic solutions that we had 20 years ago. Arguably, it's taken 20 years for some of these solutions to reach commercial utility, and there is a more compelling argument today for the introduction of these kinds of technologies for the simple reason that the global warming and climate change arguments have been taken to heart, and that there are entire generations today who have grown up learning about the effect of humans on the planet that we all share. So that is, I think, a clear difference between what we had in the 90s and today. Then when we think about the solar sector, it's also doing well, so that does suggest that there will continue to be a lot more solar panels produced, and that's obviously again coming back to the silver argument. Then when we think about low interest rates, Brookfield Renewable Partners is, I think, an interesting company. It gives a clear indication, first, of how much demand there is for renewable assets. And people feel good about buying these types of assets because they feel like that they're doing good in the world while also making money. And that really is the foundation of any big bull market, that you can feel like you are improving the lot of the entire world by buying this thing, and along the way you get to make money as well. But they're deploying what is effectively a private equity model. The parent group, which would be Brookfield Asset Management, is supplying the company with the assets it requires in order to go out and buy renewable energy infrastructure and power plants or power production facilities. Then the cash flow that those throw off generates an internal rate of return in the low teens, and then they are able to pay back those loans to the parent company, and then they also pocket a high return as a result of that, and they are capable of throwing off a dividend, which in this case is still in the region of about 3.5%. So obviously this is a business model that does fantastically well in an extremely low interest rate environment, because the internal rate of return from these types of instruments, where they can lock in a yield, they have control of a physical asset, and the supply of cash at a low interest rate is helping to acquire physical assets with real cash flows, then that's the kind of environment where private equity really thrives. And we're seeing increasing amounts of money flowing into private equity. Of course, what that also means is that they're incredibly interest rate sensitive. And when we do eventually see interest rates rising, but that probably will not happen for years to come, then they're likely to have had their asset prices inflated to such an extraordinary extent that we're probably looking at a bubble. But we're only in the early stages of that right now, because Treasury yields are at 65 basis points and so far going nowhere. And we've also heard repeatedly from central banks, whether it is the Federal Reserve talking about their determination to look at an average price for, or an average interest rate and inflation rate. Well, they're looking for an average inflation rate before they raise interest rates. Then we have the Bank of England looking at negative interest rates and determining that there haven't been any negative consequences as a result of that. Of course, they're looking at their various economies and talking about the fact that negative interest rates have not been passed on to consumers. But, of course, there is the other side of that, which is that the banking sector has been hobbled by negative interest rates, and they have been precluded from passing on those negative interest rates by governments. And then, of course, they completely understand that they can't make any money if people take their deposits away. So they simply are prohibited from passing those on. But it also means that they're prohibited from making loans. But banks today were in positive territory, and the European banking sector did bounce from the upper side of the underlying range, and it is a little oversold in the short term. HSBC received some welcome news, and it also bounced in here today. So it wasn't quite able to hold all of the advance. There are rumors that Ping An Insurance is going to take a position in HSBC. Of course, what this also represents is a Chinese takeover of the UK bank. And there is obviously an argument for that, considering it has such a large franchise in Hong Kong. Now, we've had an extraordinary decline come in through in over the course of the last year, just since January, going from 600 to 300, and that was the acceleration of an already clear downtrend. So any positive news is likely to stem the decline, but we can still see that the sequence of lower rally highs remains intact. So what's probably required is more substantive news that money will in fact be committed, rather than simply rumors. but at least this is looking positive. Then what we also saw in here today was that the NASDAQ and the S&P 500 were in positive territory. The most important thing here is that the NASDAQ has now rallied enough to push up into the most recent of the little ranges. And it's in the process of breaking that sequence of lower rally highs since the peak at the beginning of this month. So this is really quite positive action. Then we also have the fact that the S&P 500 has rallied to break its sequence of lower rally highs as well. So it's finding support in the region of the trend mean and the 3200 point level. So this is this so far has been a rather benign environment. We had two big downward days at the beginning of the contraction, but since then it's been relatively modest on the downside, and now we're starting to see some steadying action. Then when, of course, we look at the dollar index, it was in negative territory in here today. So it has still held the breakout from this short-term range, and it has certainly broken the downtrend that's been in evidence since March. But there is the prospect that there will be additional liquidity infusions. We're coming to the end of the PPP program, where people, where companies were going to be forgiven the amount of money that they borrowed from the government, provided they held on to their employees until the end of September. Well, that's only 2 days from now. So there is something of a timeline. And of course, we have got the US presidential election in only a month away, or a little bit more than a month away. There are obviously some big machinations going on in the background about whether it is politically expedient to let the economy have a bit of a shock in the next 3 weeks in order to sway political opinion one way or the other, or whether it is probably better to show that concern for the economy trumps immediate political capital that may be gained. So those are big questions, whether politicians have the emotional wherewithal to in fact agree to a new deal. But one way or the other, there is going to be a significant round of additional spending. It just depends on whether that is going to be before or after the election. I've drawn some comparisons in here today with regard to the coronavirus and the emotional response that we get heading into a peak in the stock market following or during the decline, following the decline, and then the subsequent recovery. Because it's usually after a big decline in the stock market that people become most disciplined about stops. And we can then think about how disciplined are they about stops at the top. Well, at the top, it's very few people sell at the top. Then most people are less likely to have a stop at the peak because they don't want to be stopped out. They don't want to be taken out at the first sign of some volatility, because they have been conditioned over the length of the bull market to accept occasional bouts of volatility. So they want to see a bigger and more sustained period of volatility before they're willing to sell. And of course, that's fine in theory until that volatility in fact turns up. Then people decide that they need to sell aggressively and become extremely activist in selling everything. Then when the decline occurs, more people will become convinced that the decline will be interminable. And then even when we get confirming data that the lows are in, people are still waiting for the second shoe to drop, and they don't believe that the low is in. In fact, it's at that point they become even more risk averse and even more disciplined about stops. And yet the stock market can generally rally after an episode like that. That was exactly the kind of condition that we had in 2009. People were waiting for the second shoe to drop and the next big decline all the way through until about 2011, even though the market bottomed in March of 2009. Well, now let's just go back and think about the response to the coronavirus. News was breaking in early January about this virus, and there was a risk it was going to become a pandemic, but nobody really thought of that as being entirely credible. By the time it got to the end of January, it was a clear risk because there was a cruise ship in Italy was pumping out new cases. The death toll, in fact, peaked in late March, but the lockdowns, full-on lockdowns, occurred afterwards. Well, that's very similar to what happens in the stock market. It's almost like closing the door after the barn door after the horse has bolted. Now we're looking at a situation where the number of deaths has cratered, and yet the risk aversion of consumers and governments is higher than ever. And there are stories of draconian enforcement of nonsensical social distancing rules all over the world. So this risk aversion has reached hysterical proportions. And that is probably even greater confirmation that we have already seen the peak in deaths. Now, obviously, we're going to continue to see bad news coming through. But the stock market bottomed in March. It's quite likely that it's unlikely to be retested, but that we are going to have occasional bouts of volatility, but that as long as the liquidity continues to flow, and there is absolutely no reason to believe that it will not, then we're likely to continue to see additional upside, and that the shakeout that we've seen in the stock market could be approaching its end right now. That's as true of Wall Street as it is of other regions. Europe has taken has had more cases and has had more of a lockdown recently. So that may be weighing on it in the short term, but the stock market is certainly bouncing right now. The Eurostox is right in the region of the trend mean. The DAX index is bouncing from the region of the trend mean. We've had risk off for most of the last month, and I think we are starting to move into more of a risk on environment, and not least as we are approaching the end of the quarter and investors are positioning for the fourth quarter. And so far, the environment still looks reasonably benign for the simple reason that we're looking at the continued provision of additional liquidity. The more fear that governments have that the coronavirus is going to be a problem, the more willing they're likely to be to continue to supply liquidity. And then, of course, once it's all run its course and they are probably still waiting for the security blanket of the vaccines in order to sound the all clear, I think the most likely scenario is that we're going to see one country after another loosen their restrictions and be more public in trying to identify what the risks are and what the measures that they can take to protect the most vulnerable people in society will be, and then for everyone else to just get on with their lives. But the hit that's been taken to consumer sentiment is probably in the order of about 20%. And when we look at the outlook for some of the more successful retailers, they are still trading today around where they were in about 2018. So that's probably about right, that we've had a significant pullback, but it's not a terminal I think not a terminal body blow for these companies, and they are likely to do better in future. And certainly those that survive will be in a better competitive position because they'll have more of the market to compete for when so many have already gone out of business. So there is a clear potential that the survivors out of this crisis are likely to be the survivors, that the retail apocalypse has probably gone about as far as it's going to go, that the other companies that are left behind will, and there will be new companies, will fill in the spaces. So I think that's rather important. We're also seeing that there are increasing stories of companies that have done spectacularly well. And this is very similar to the kind of condition you get with, and it was very clear in 2009 and early 2010, you'd meet people that said, oh, I made 100% in Citigroup, or I made 100% in Bank of America or Lloyd's. And it's because that they were trading and they bought low and they sold quickly. Well, I met someone over the weekend that he had invested heavily in advertising for his online business, and he had grown his turnover to $1 million a month. And that was purely on the back of the fact that he was able to negotiate aggressively. He was able to get in with a high-profile advertising company that had seen their revenues decrease substantially. They wouldn't talk to him a year ago, but they were more than happy to take his business because of the coronavirus. And that's a perfect example of the kind of changes that take place, where people are extremely aggressive in taking opportunities and then come out of the crisis in a much stronger position, where simply weak hands give way to stronger hands. And that's exactly what we see in every type of bear market. It's increasingly likely that the hysteria we're seeing in the way that governments and people react to this problem is an ending signal, and that it can only get better from here. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.